On this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
It really helps you figure out how to optimize your health and then maximize your health span. And we take all that and try to contextualize it for you as well.
Let's walk through that. How can this report advise people as to how they should be eating?
You know, 95 years old, decreasing your cholesterol is only going to decrease your risk of a heart attack by the age of 95 by 3%.
I'm a renaissance man of fitness, but I'm never going to be a professional power lifter or an elite marathoner.
And we're working on the basketball score. We'll have that on the next version as well. Yeah.
Health. Performance. Nutrition, longevity, ancestral living, biohacking, and much more. My name is Ben Greenfield. Welcome to the show.
Well, folks, as you know, there's all sorts of crazy tests out there you can get done on your body, and I'm visiting today with a couple of really smart docs about one of the newer varieties of such tests that I've been pretty dang impressed with. It's called Clarity, and my interview today is with the good doctors, Mike Mullen and Matt Dawson from Wild Health. I think you're going to dig it. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor. All right, folks. Clinical research has shown that therapeutically and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits, and inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, holy moly, folks. I have like a 50-page health report sitting in front of me right now that has kind of tied in my genetics, my epigenome, my microbiome, a whole bunch of factors, blood, biomarkers, stool, you name it. And it's pretty comprehensive. I literally have just been poring over it this morning in preparation for today's show, because it's a brand new report rolled out by some folks you may be familiar with if you have been a listener for some time to my show, the good physicians over at Wild Health. Now, Wild Health has basically just rolled out this brand new, impressively comprehensive biomarkers test that they worked with a bunch of MDs and PhDs and data scientists and software developers on, that just takes all of your data and puts it in one place and then spits out a pretty cool report based on what is found from your data. And it even ties in wearables. Like I know that this report got connected to my Aura ring, etc. So all sorts of cool things. But my guests today are Dr. Matt Dawson and Dr. Mike Mullen. These guys are multi-time repeat podcast guests on my show. They're the lead physicians at Wild Health, which you can check out over at wildhealth.com. They have locations and physicians spread all over the U.S. I interviewed them about precision medicine a few years ago, and then we came back and did a whole podcast about DNA. And then a couple of months ago, did another podcast on biohacking the brain. What I'll do is I'll link to all those previous podcast episodes with these guys if you go to the show notes for today's episode, which is at bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity, like C-L-A-R-I-T-Y, bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity. My first guest is Dr. Matt Dawson. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Ben. It's been a long time no see.
Long time no see. It's in like 5 days. I think I was down there at the Kentucky Castle with you eating oxtail and bone marrow at that wonderful farm-to-table restaurant you guys have. So yes, for those of you listening in, I have just returned from Kentucky, where my only mistake was not kicking Matt's ass in basketball, as is my traditional approach when I visit Kentucky. Matt he's a wealth of knowledge in all things precision medicine, as is his partner in crime, Mike Mullen. What's up, Mike?
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
I'm good. I am a little bit overwhelmed with the size of this report that's on my desktop, but I think we'll remedy that shortly. And while Matt is based out of Kentucky, for those of you listening in, Mike is actually based out of Oregon. So between the two of these guys, they have the U.S. completely covered. So fellas, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us. We're super excited to show you this today, Ben.
Oh yeah. So tell me about the history behind this report. Cause you've been hinting to me for a few months that you guys have been working on something behind the scenes, but I'm just curious because, you know, as you guys know, there's freaking like Viome and Longevity and Wellness FX and Inside Tracker. I mean, you can't swing a dead cat by the tail, so they say, without hitting some kind of fancy new comprehensive biomarker report that's available on the internet. So I think that's probably the first question that I'm going to get from folks. And the first thing I'm kind of wondering myself, what is this report and what makes it any different than anything else that might be out there?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So we have been obsessed with the idea of precision medicine for several years now. So we know that there is a tremendous amount of power when we look at DNA, but we also know that there's a lot missing. Just to look at someone's SNPs, for example, just doesn't give you much information. So people will talk about polygenic risk scores, so combining different DNA and different SNPs to give you risk scores. So that's good. That's better. But there's also blood biomarkers. There's also microbiome data. There's all of this that we bring together in to do multiomics. So that's the real kind of holy grail in the next step, being able to combine it all for better recommendations. And we were doing that, but that's hard. So like to take all of that into account, when Mike and I first started practicing this way, we would have hundreds of pages of data in front of us, all these SNPs, tens of thousands of SNPs, all the blood work, the microbiome, the patient questionnaires, and we try to bring it all together. It's a lot of fun, but it's difficult. It'll take hours upon hours. So we have been obsessively, like you mentioned earlier, working with MDs, PhDs, data scientists, software developers to really systematize this and to get one report that you can use, the 30 to 50 pages, depending on how much data we have to put into it, that really helps you figure out how to optimize your health and then maximize your health span. And we take all that and try to contextualize it for you as well. So not just give you the multi-omic report, but then talk to you about your lifestyle and figure out how to actually give you recommendations that fit within your lifestyle to quickly get you to that optimization.
Okay, so basically, this is largely once someone comes to you, and let's say they've got, you know, in my case, it was a whole Dropbox folder of all my labs over the past few years that I shared with you guys, along with access to some of my wearables, like the Oura Ring, for example. You guys don't have like some monkey in a corner going through all of this, you know, tapping away at a keyboard. What you've done is actually developed like a software algorithm that pulls in all this data so it's scalable.
Yeah, we were the monkeys and we decided that we hated tapping that in. So yeah, it's been over a year we've been working on this, a large team, like we mentioned. And so now we just upload all of the data into the program and we get the report, and then we get to sit down and have fun and run through it with you and talk about it.
Okay, cool. I'm going to see if I can find any holes as we go through the report to see if I can tear your algorithm to pieces here. So be forewarned. And by the way, again, for those of you listening in, if you go to the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity, we're also going to be video recording this as well, if you guys would rather follow along with the screenshot overview of each page that we go through. And then I'm also going to, at that same URL, have my comprehensive report available for any of you who want to download it and snicker at all the things that are wrong with my body. I'm just going to put that all available while blurring out my address and phone number and all my sensitive data. So that's all going to be over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity. So basically the overall vision here is you guys, you know, with this massive health clinic with all these locations across the U.S., what you want to do is be able to allow physicians to free up time to meet one-on-one with their patients about their results from a test like this without actually having to put together this comprehensive report themselves, which would take hours and hours and hours. You're essentially using software algorithms and AI to generate the report, and then the doctor gets on the phone call like we're doing right now with the patient.
Yeah, and that's a really important point. So you talk about tearing holes in this and ripping it apart. We have to take this in the context of you. There's no report that's ever going to be able to fully capture you, who you are, Ben. So we're going to get as close as we can with all the algorithms and the AI, like you mentioned, and then we're going to go through it step by step and talk about all this and see where there are holes, where we need to apply our brain and your knowledge about your body to adjust it. So it's really important that this is in the context of a provider and patient relationship.
Okay. Got it. Well, the report itself is it's beautiful. It's multicolored, so that's good. It's a good start. Delivered to me in a PDF this morning via email. And as I look at it here, there's obviously the title page, and then it begins to delve into kind of like my overall health assessment. And I actually want to largely hand the reins over to you guys to kind of walk me through this the way that a patient would be walked through this as we educate the audience about the things to look at when they're looking at their own lab results that might, you know, influence decisions that they make. So where do we start here?
So let me just describe what the report is, and then I'm going to let Mike jump in because he's really the one that really led this, the development of it all. So we start with an overall assessment. So we have a little graphic here of your tree of life. I mean, we had to put a couple of corny graphics in here. And in this tree of life, we have the roots, which are the things that we really want to have a good baseline with: your insulin resistance, your cardiovascular disease risk, your cancer risk, your sleep, exercise, your gut health. And once we optimize those, then the leaves of the tree, things we focus on, are like a mindfulness track we have, or brain optimization, longevity, biohacking. We get into those things. So that's what that graphic is about. And we start off with just an overall objective score. So a health optimization score out of 100. Not surprisingly, you have the highest score that we've ran so far.
Really?
You're a 90. You do. So you're a 91 right now. And what we do also, we kind of work towards optimizing people, maybe graduating them from the program eventually. And this score helps us figure out how long. So are we going to need to be working with you for a few months, for 6 months? And technically, you fall under the graduated. You're the first person who's graduated without us actually helping them out in here. But the thing about the score is you get a number, but we tell you why. So we see where are the areas of improvement, how are we going to get that score up, and then we start working from there. And the overall score is both an objective score. You got a 91 out of 100. And then we also, to contextualize that, show you your epigenetic age. So, for example, you had ran one of the epigenetic tests, and so we show you your epigenetic age, where you are, as well as that objective score. And then we start diving in. So the areas that we look at are your diet and nutrition, how to optimize your macronutrient and micronutrient intake, your exercise and recovery, how to optimize that. And we have a specific plan that is based on maximizing longevity, which we would adjust with the patient depending on what their goals were and what they do. Talk about sleep optimization, how your DNA fits into that. A neurobehavioral segment, a segment on your microbiome, if you have a microbiome report and how we're going to improve that. Mm-hmm. Looking at your chronic disease, so we know that as Americans, the thing most likely to get you is cardiovascular disease. So we have a risk calculator, show you your short and long-term risk of cardiovascular disease. Then we get into longevity genes and how to maximize your health span. And then we have a bunch of nerdy stuff at the end, some glossary of terms and all the SNPs that we look at. So that's how it's broken down.
Well, who picks what's important? I mean, because obviously, you know, like you mentioned, you have like this tree of life that primarily is focused on insulin resistance, cardiovascular disease, cancer, sleep, exercise, and gut. You know, but I'm just curious, was that something you guys subjectively decided to include on the report? You know, why wouldn't something like, let's say, hormones be at the base of the tree, for example? Like who chose what actually feeds into this?
We had to just kind of arbitrarily pick some. I mean, hormones we're going to cover. Like, we have your hormone labs here and how to optimize that. And it'll play a little bit into your long-term risk and longevity. And so all of these components are part of it. We just had to pick some overall big ticket items that we would talk about with people.
We tried to create something that's going to continue to grow, you know, with us and with our patients. So I suspect that, you know, probably in the coming month or two, we'll be adding things like hormones to the roots. This is a living document and it's going to change over time as we develop new things. But we had to commit to, you know, say six things that we felt were just the absolute most important things that we had to address.
Got it. All right. So do you want to go through this thing chronologically so folks can kind of learn some stuff by going through my report?
Yeah, for sure. Let's dive into diet and nutrition first.
Sounds good.
So here, if we look at your tree, Ben, the only place where we gave you any orange in your roots was on sleep. And that was from looking at your aura ring data.
Orange meaning something that could be improved.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So even if I look at the next page here, it tells you your wild health score. So you got 91 out of 100. And those numbers were all for sleep, basically. So that's really the only area that we really identified that there is a significant opportunity for improvement.
And that was based on my aura ring data showing, what was it? It was a certain element of sleep that was considered unfavorable, like deep versus light. Was it the amount of sleep? Does it get that detailed?
It does. Yeah. So we docked you points for your deep sleep, your REM sleep, and your total amount of sleep that you get. I will give you credit that you give yourself greater than 8 hours every night for sleep. You know, I think your average is about 8 hours and 15 minutes, but you only come out with a little over 7 hours of sleep on average. If I look at the last 3 years of data,
I'm going to push back just briefly here. One thing that, and I think this is almost like a little bit of a failure of a lot of these sleep wearables, I take a 20 to 40 minute nap every single day. And when I do that, even though I often am sleeping, say, 7 hours for an 8 hour night in bed, due to, let's say, something like restlessness at night or a long sleep latency, I actually find my readiness, my HRV, everything is just fine as long as I'm taking an afternoon nap. And I find some of these wearables, they actually don't factor in, you know, me crashing for an afternoon siesta. So I think some issues with sleep can be mitigated with simply an afternoon nap and or meditation session.
Yeah, 100%. So this is exactly what I was talking about, contextualizing. So when we see this in your data, our first question, and before we say you need to improve, is, do you wake up without an alarm? Let's talk about your sleep. When do you go to bed? When do you wake up? How do you feel? Do you nap during the day? Things like that. Because, yeah, these wearables, they don't pick up everything. And sometimes they don't read on different individuals perfectly as well. So all those things are really important. So that's what we were talking about with the report, is never going to capture all that. And that's why the relationship and the conversation is just really critical.
Right. Okay. Got it. So basically, I got docked on sleep, and that's why my overall health score isn't that great, or is not as high as it could be. And then based on that, well, it looks like this report actually starts with diet and nutrition, but I don't want to confuse people by erring away from sleep too soon. Is there a section of the report that specifically focuses here on like genes that would be related to circadian rhythm or anything else that could advise a patient or someone looking at this report about sleep?
There is. And sleep is going to be a little more guided just by the conversation. So we talk about when you go to sleep, what the last 2 hours or so before sleep, what your morning looks like. And then we get into light and dark and EMF and all the things, the temperature, all the things that affect your sleep. So we do look at your genetics. And so if you scroll all the way down, if you want to skip to the sleep area there.
Okay,
there
yeah, are, I see here, page 24, my circadian genetics. So you guys actually looked at certain gene SNPs, it appears here, that specifically affect my personal sleep patterns.
Exactly. So, for example, you had an NPAS2 polymorphism, and this is associated with eating late. So you have a slightly increased risk of cancer, not a big risk, if you have alterations in your circadian rhythm. So we tell you not to eat late at night. You also have an ADA polymorphism. And this is important because people who have disrupted sleep, they are probably going to have potentially some issues which is with overall well-being. So it's another reason we want to focus on your sleep. So you get a few SNPs here. Again, the sleep, it's more kind of behavioral and just talking to you and optimizing over time. And it takes a little bit of time because we have all these things that could affect your sleep in a positive way, but we want to do experiments with you. Like you had an FAAH polymorphism that said you would probably have better sleep with CBD. So I don't know if that's true for you or not, but that's one of the things we do to immediately.
So my endocannabinoid genetics dictate that CBD would help me to sleep. It looks like another interesting one on here is even though I'm a fast coffee oxidizer, this gene called the ADORA2A gene shows that regardless, I should stop caffeine consumption afternoon because I have a gene that carries increased risk for altered sleep with caffeine intake. And that's interesting because I've always thought I could get away with a little bit of caffeine afternoon because I'm a fast coffee oxidizer and it doesn't really seem to disrupt my sleep that much. But I should maybe experiment with just totally stopping, even though I'm a fast coffee oxidizer, caffeine consumption afternoon.
And this is exactly why we want to look at multiple SNPs at the same time. So, for example, you are a fast caffeine metabolizer. So we know based on several studies, it may improve your athletic performance. But with this ADORA2A polymorphism, you probably want to time that correctly. Mm-hmm. So being able to know those things in context is really important.
Okay. Yeah. Another thing that's interesting here for context, because I get this a lot, I have this conversation with athletes quite a bit, is you highlighted just a few moments ago the gene that the NPAS2 gene that shows that if I eat when it's dark or I eat too close to bedtime, it's going to disrupt sleep. Yet, especially, you know, when I was competing heavily in triathlon and Spartan racing, and a little bit less so now, even though I'm pretty physically active, you know, I do a tough workout typically in the afternoon or, you know, the later afternoon, early evening hours, kind of like pre-dinner. I find if I'm physically active, my sleep actually goes hot unless I have a meal about 2.5 hours prior to bedtime. I actually have heavily disrupted sleep patterns because I lay awake in bed at night hungry, and I suspect I also get reduced melatonin secretion due to absence of carbohydrate intake unless I actually, you know, break some of the rules that guys like, you know, Dr. Sachin Panda will propose and eat an evening meal. And I actually eat a pretty hefty evening meal, you know, typically like 1200, 1500 calories for dinner. And I sleep so much better with an evening meal. And the only time when that wouldn't be the case is if I'm not exercising, like if I've just done a yoga session that day or an easy walk or something like that.
One thing I'll often do for that, Ben, is I'll look at the Oura Ring data and look at your resting heart rate and see if there is an elevation in your resting heart rate in the first half of the night, which we'll often see if people are eating too soon close to bed because you're spending too much energy metabolizing, keeping your heart rate up. If you're not getting that and still eating right before bed, then you're probably doing fine. And that probably means that you've got fairly fast transit or you needed the extra energy. So it's good to bring in the Oura Ring data with that and try to get an idea of how you're metabolizing while you're sleeping.
Right. Yeah, it would be interesting to correlate sleep patterns with the actual activity patterns. And, you know, and this is probably too far out in the future, but maybe also bring in like a nutrition tracking software and say, well, this is what this person ate on this day, pair that to the activity levels, and then step back and look at how sleep is affected.
Yeah, we do that all the time. So we do that through our health coaches. And what I would say about you, your food intake and sleep is you're not normal. No one is normal. So that's why this subjective feedback that you told us about your workouts and things and how you sleep is really, really important. And then we design experiments. So you say, this is how I feel with these foods at this time. And then if someone is interested in really optimizing and digging in, then yeah, you just use chronometer or something like that to track. And we have your Oura Ring data that we're pulling in and we can look over time. I mean, we do this at a patient just came to me yesterday and his Apple Watch, it had an episode of AFib the week before. And we were able to go back to that exact instance and look at what he ate the night before, because he was tracking the chronometer and look at his Oura Ring data. And it really helped us dig in to combine all of that at the same time. So those trackers and being able to have that is really helpful as we combine it with your baseline genetics and blood work.
Okay, makes sense. Well, we got kind of sidetracked there, going like starting off halfway down through the report, going through some of these sleep parameters. But it is interesting how you guys tie in. I thought the most interesting part was looking over some of my specific genes and how those affect my sleep patterns. But then we were also, before we kind of took that rabbit hole down into sleep, you had mentioned that one of the first things that is shown on this report, and I can see this with the report in front of me, is diet and nutrition. So let's walk through that. How can this report advise people as to how they should be eating?
So we start off with macronutrients, so fat, carb, saturated fat, protein. And then we go into micronutrients and methylation. So we're starting here with the macronutrients, and we display these risk scores. So you have a fat intolerance risk score, carb intolerance, and saturated fat. And that includes a combination of your genomics as well as your laboratory values to decide what sort of scores you get here. So here, I'll just tell you, your carb intolerance score of 58% is coming primarily from genetics, because you have no evidence of insulin resistance. If there was evidence of insulin resistance, then your carb intolerance score would be altered by that. Same goes for saturated fat. So this is primarily genetic. If your cholesterol was elevated, or there's other evidence of saturated fat intolerance in your biomarkers, then that would be increased as well. So this gives us an idea of sort of how your body is, what your body is best apt at using for energy, whether it's fat, carb, or saturated fat. And it's amazing the variance we see in patients regarding all of these scores. And I'll tell you, Ben, I'm actually kind of surprised that your intolerance numbers are as high as they are, because it's higher than a lot of our patients.
Yeah, I think you're
well. I find this also kind of interesting, guys, and I know this podcast is going to be rife with interruptions, and hopefully my audience can bear with me as I throw all my questions out there. So, you know, this report is saying my saturated fat should be less than 7% of my total calorie intake. One of the reasons that it says that is because I have high cholesterol, although I have zero risk factors such as glucose, high triglycerides, inflammation, etc. That would potentially make that cholesterol atherosclerotic or cause it to become a risk factor. Furthermore, I feel amazing when I eat a higher fat intake, although this says, you know, eat less red meat, less butter, less ghee, less MCT oil, etc., and more nuts, seeds, fish, extra virgin olive oil. Some of those I agree with. Some of those I'll push back due to the industrial seed oils and linoleic acid and omega-6 content, etc. I actually don't quite agree with those recommendations, but I feel really, really good eating a high intake of monounsaturated and saturated fats particularly. And this report seems to indicate that cholesterol is considered to be a bad thing, but I know that both of you guys are aware that it's not. I know you guys are well aware of a lot of the flaws with cholesterol being vilified. Is this report spitting out recommendations that aren't taking into account whether or not the cholesterol is actually a true risk factor?
No. So again, this is about contextualization. So in general, we do know that higher LDL, much higher LDL, is going to increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. However, for you, it's really important to put this in context, one of just your overall risk.
Well, I'm going to stop you. You said it'll increase risk of cardiovascular disease. It's a factor that's necessary for increased risk of cardiovascular disease, but that in and alone is not sufficient. I would say that statement isn't true.
By itself, no, it is not enough. But over time, over the course of 50 years, like, you have no insulin resistance right now. There's no inflammation, so we're not worried. So the way we talk about this with someone like you is, we do not need to push that number lower. Like, you're totally fine. How you feel and how you perform is going to be the most important component here. So, but what we can look is, okay, what about 50 years from now, 60 years from now? And this is not something that we would make a change on. So, for example, when we go down to your cardiovascular report, we see that what would happen if we did try to push your LDL from 125 to 100? What would happen? Because if you just go to a regular physician, a lot of times they would try to do that. They would try to get you to go under LDL. And what does that mean for you? It means that as a 95-year-old, by the time you're 95, you may decrease your cardiovascular event rate from 33% to 30%, a 3% absolute reduction, which is tiny. That means in alternate universes, 1 out of 30 bends would benefit from pushing that down. That is a tiny benefit. and probably not worth the effort to do it, either changing your diet or certainly not medications. So again, this is, we would never just hand this report to someone because we don't want them to be confused by their LDL being in the red category at 125. You do not need to decrease your saturated fats. So if you were to just look at DNA and you were to just look at lab tests and look at kind of the standard dogma from medicine, we would be saying decrease it. But again, we take this report, we talk to people about it and figure out what their goals are. Now, if you were 70 and you had insulin resistance and you had inflammation, your risk calculators would be very, very different. And so we would be trying to push that number down. So the report is never going to stand on its own. It is a jumping off point to actually be able to practice precision medicine when a physician and patient are talking to each other and they can talk about what it means to decrease your LDL from 125 to 100, which is not much benefit for you, if any. And so we just would not recommend that you do that.
The better way to look at saturated fat intolerance, Ben, is almost as a measure of whether you're likely to respond to reducing saturated fat in your diet in terms of would that reduce your LDL cholesterol. So, you know, if I look back at your LDL cholesterols, because I've got a ton of them in that document that you shared with me, 125, which is what your current concentration is, higher, a good bit higher than you have been in the past. So I'm not sure how your diet has necessarily changed over the last 4 or 5 years, but I suspect that the difference is probably related to saturated fat based on what I see here regarding your genetics. And this saturated fat intolerance that you're seeing at 53%, that is actually 100% from your genetics, because you don't get any bump from an LDL cholesterol of 125, because realistically, that's pretty low, especially if I look at, you know, how high your HDL is, your total cholesterol numbers. I mean, your ratios are pretty good. Your triglycerides are excellent, right? There's no, and as you mentioned, there's no inflammation, there's no insulin resistance. There's no reason otherwise to suggest that you've got a significant risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And like Matt was saying, if we plug you into the risk calculators and we look at your risk at, you know, 95 years old, you know, decreasing your cholesterol is only going to decrease your risk of a heart attack by the age of 95 by 3%.
All right, folks, clinical research has shown that therapeutically, and for overall health and well-being, the most critical time to ground is when you sleep. The electrons you absorb when grounding neutralizes free radical damage, squelches inflammation, restores healthy endocrine function, enhances cellular gating and circulation. That then improves the cellular uptake of nutrients and oxygen and hormones while maximizing the removal of cellular waste. And you can now ground when you sleep. This company called Ultimate Longevity makes indoor grounded sleeping devices, and they've done clinical research studies on grounding the human body for health. When you sleep on these mats, you get 6 to 8 hours of uninterrupted grounding, meaning I could travel, unroll it onto my hotel room bed, and fight all of the radiation, the inflammation I got from flying in the airplane right there during a full night of sleep. Full body grounding, which is what these mats give you versus just your feet on the ground, maximizes the electron transfer, because the more surface area contact, the more beneficial the electrons, the more the results. So you get these amazing benefits, and inside your body, this stream of electrons works as an anti-inflammatory, pain-relieving, anti-aging, antioxidant boost, squelching inflammation all night long. They've got over 20 peer-reviewed research studies that have been published on the extensive health benefits of grounding. For vagal tone, serum electrolytes, thyroid function, blood glucose, blood viscosity, sleep, pain, stiffness, blood pressure, stress, even depression and anxiety. It's crazy. So you can go to ultimatelongevity.com/Ben to get your hands on these grounding mats. You can do mattress, pillow, blankets, a whole bunch of other valuable tools to help you bring your inflammation down and jumpstart your healing process. Again, it's ultimatelongevity.com/Ben. Well, folks, you and I, or the average American at least, spend an average of 90% of time indoors, breathing around 30,000 gallons of air daily. According to the EPA, indoor air can be 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoor air, and in some cases, 100 times more polluted, especially like your home gym where you're breathing in even more air. This can be a serious issue. Data shows that air pollution is responsible for nearly 7 million premature deaths around the world. So you need air purifying technology, and the one that I like as a standalone system that doesn't require you to go re-outfit your entire home's AC system or ducts is called the Air Doctor. The Air Doctor filters out dangerous contaminants and allergens like pollen, pet dander, dust mites, and mold, so your lungs don't need to. Their Ultra HEPA filter has been independently tested to remove 99.99% of tested bacteria and viruses and virtually 100% of particles as small as 0.003 microns. They also feature whisper jet fans, 30% quieter than normal ordinary air purifiers, and they are extremely affordable and accessible. Furthermore, they're going to give you up to 39% off of one of their extremely impressive and efficacious air filters, or up to $300 off today. Here's how you lock this in. You go to airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You can get one with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund, minus shipping, but you're going to love it. airdoctorpro.com/BenG. You'll get up to 39% off or up to $300 off. So lock it in today, folks. You'll enjoy it. Clean air is something everybody deserves. You can get it with the Air Doctor.
Just to throw this out there, I'm definitely not a guy who's jamming down butter and coconut oil and lard all day. I actually get the majority of my fats from monounsaturated sources, although I would say my saturated fat is definitely higher than what is recommended here, which would be 7% of my total calories. However, I'm not one of those guys who endorses the kind of like the keto fat bomb approach versus a more Mediterranean fat approach, with the clarification, like I mentioned earlier. I think too many people who are eating a higher fat intake or prioritizing fats are getting too much industrial seed oils, linoleic acid, omega-6s, seeds, nuts, etc. The other thing that's kind of interesting on this report is I note that it says I'm intolerant to carbohydrates. This is, I assume, based on a genetic reading. It says reduce simple carbs and consider a high-fat, low-carb diet. But directly underneath that, it says you are intolerant to high-fat diets and are unlikely to respond well to a high-fat diet. So which is it? Do I eat the high-fat, low-carb diet or the high-carb, low-fat diet? Because if you scroll down to page 37, it tells me I need to be eating a high-carb, low-fat diet based on my insulin resistance scores. So the report seems to be giving me mixed messages when it comes to high-fat, low-carb versus high-carb, low-fat. Is that kind of a relic of the algorithm spitting out recommendations in a specific section, or what's going on there?
Yeah, and this is with medicine in general. You're going to have multiple labs, multiple genetics all the time. They're going to be conflicting. So you notice that these boxes with the recommendations are text fields. So it starts with a general recommendation based on your genetics and your labs, and then we adjust it based on the context and based on which is more important. Because there's always going to be, I mean, any DNA calculator or something you put where you upload your raw data and then you get recommendations, you're going to find a lot of these things that are conflicting. And you have to just talk about the power, like what each one does in different directions, changing them up or down. So that's where the conversation again and us going through it step by step, because for someone who is not as active as you, for example, doesn't have your lifestyle, it may be that with just your genetics, decreasing your saturated fat lower to that level may confer a benefit. But for you, it simply does not. So we change those text fields based on how all of this comes together after the long conversation.
Got it. Yeah, I think that's super important. It's something I actually see over and over again. It's not just in your guys' report, but in a lot of these reports that where you can tell which parts are spit out by a computer, sometimes the computer makes seemingly contradictory recommendations in different sections of the report, which is why, again, I think it's really important to actually hop on the horn with a doctor or a nutritionist or someone, even when you're going through a comprehensive report like this, because, you know, like you were just noting, Mike, for example, someone, let's say, might fit genetically into the category of a high-fat, low-carb diet. Right, that might be the diet that is found to be correct for them genetically, a ketogenic approach. But what that computer doesn't know is that that person signed up for an Ironman triathlon and they're exercising for 2 hours a day and their carbohydrate throughput needs might be, you know, 40 to 60% on some days of their total calorie intake. And so sometimes the computer doesn't recognize that or take that into account.
It's virtually impossible to create a report that's going to be 100% accurate without like just like an unreasonable amount of input beforehand. So, I mean, if you sat down and filled out a 300-page survey, I could probably make this report that accurate, right? But you're not going to do that. You don't want to do that. You'd rather have a conversation with me about it. So, you know, one thing you haven't seen, Ben, is that all of these recommendations are all completely editable by the physician as they're talking to you, and they can say whatever they want. And that allows us to modify as we're sort of going through this. So think of this report more as like a blueprint, a starting off point that we can use to make some recommendations and to really talk with you on a very granular level about how you want to live your life. Maybe you feel terrible on a high fat diet and you don't want to eat that way. Maybe, like you said, you're doing an Ironman. So these are really important aspects that we have to go over with patients. And really, this report is just the jumping off point.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That makes sense. All right. So we kind of got into the weeds there a little bit in terms of some of the macronutrient ratios that are recommended in the diet section of this report. But I'm seeing that also in the diet and nutrition section, it gets into some other things like, you know, methylation, et cetera. So what do we cover next here when it comes to the diet and nutrition piece?
So next up, as you mentioned, is methylation. So here we look at your homocysteine level and sort of chart that on an optimal to suboptimal level. Yours was 6.8, which is phenomenal. So that's really good news. And then we look at sort of the reasons that your methylation could be inadequate. So we have things like a choline risk score that looks genetically at what your risk is for having a higher dietary choline requirement. We look at a folate risk score, which is really mostly just looking at your risk for requiring elevated B vitamins or MTHFR function, for example. And then we also look at TMAO, because this is a good place for us to sort of evaluate what your risk is for having elevated TMAO levels, whether you think that's a risk factor for cardiovascular disease or not. So when we go through those, you know, you, for example, you've got excellent methylation, which is probably a function of a good diet and supplementation, I suspect. And then looking here, your highest risk is really associated with choline. So we'll see here that, you know, you've got a PEMT malformation, you've got an MTHFD1. So both of those probably increase your necessary choline intake fairly significantly. And you'll see that here. We'll basically make recommendations regarding your homocysteine level and elevation or evidence of decreased methylation here, make recommendations regarding whether it's choline or whether we need to increase your B12 or your folate intake. This would be where you would see all those things. Because you have a normal homocysteine, there's very little recommendations to be made regarding methylation. There is, however, probably some question regarding the ALT and AST. So one thing I noticed on your labs, Ben, was that you fairly consistently had some minor elevations in your LFTs. Has that ever been looked at?
Was that the liver enzymes, the LFTs?
Yep.
Yeah. That is pretty common, especially in folks, as you guys know, who have done any type of hefty exercise session anywhere, you know, from 1 to 3 days prior to the test, which is usually the case with me. The couple of times I have tested and not shown elevated liver enzymes were after kind of like washout recovery weeks. So I think that my elevated liver enzymes are a relic of things like weight training, resistance exercise, you know, high intensity interval training, and the same things that, you know, would influence a doctor to tell someone who came into their clinic and had like a HSCRP test. And if that doctor did not know that person worked out hard the day prior, they might tell them, well, you're at high risk for a heart attack because of your CRP levels, when in fact all that happened was the person exercised the day prior. So I think the elevated liver enzymes are due to exercise personally.
Yeah, I 100% agree with you. And I suspected that as the case. Your LDH was elevated with it, which is also common. And we sometimes see that also as an elevation in the creatinine. And yours has been fairly consistently just very mildly elevated. I will say, however, that people who have a PEMT polymorphism often have slight elevations in their AST and ALT, especially if they're on a high fat diet and they're not getting adequate choline. So sometimes what I'll often do is, if there are elevations in AST and ALT, I'll actually up the choline intake in patients to see if I can get their choline levels elevated so that we can help sort of package that fat and get it out of the liver. Because this can sometimes be evidence of early non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which I think is unlikely in your case because you have zero insulin resistance and we know that you exercise regularly and eat well. But in the setting of a PEMT polymorphism, that's totally something to think about.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, considering especially the fact that based on the bloods that you guys are working with, you know, I'm eating not a strict carnivore diet, but I'm eating a diet that's pretty high in things like salmon and pork chops and, you know, ribeye steaks and bone broth and a large amount of liver and you know, shellfish. And I'm getting in a lot of things that would tend to lend a great deal of choline to my diet. The only thing I don't eat a lot of are eggs. I might have like, you know, 4 eggs a week. So I feel like I'm getting a decent amount of choline, but what you're suggesting is that I could potentially step that up even more and see benefit?
Yeah, and we don't like to guess. So we like to set up experiments and be objective about this. So for example, this happens all the time, elevated LFTs or elevated CRP, and we talk, and yeah, they had a hard workout the night before. Well, in that case, great. Let's just take a few days off. Let's recheck. And if everything's normal, awesome, we're done. But if it's not, then let's go down this path. Maybe you get an ultrasound for the NAFLD, or maybe you try choline. We like to set up these objective experiments to really ferret this out and not just say, yep, hard workout, we're good.
An ultrasound for NAFLD, meaning looking with an ultrasound to see if non-alcoholic fatty liver disease is present.
Exactly.
Interesting. I've never actually done one of those, but that would be, it'd actually be, I don't know if you guys heard the big heart health episode that I recorded down in LA where we just did every test known to man on my ticker. It would be interesting to based on the history of elevated liver enzymes, just double check and see if there is anything else going on in the liver from a diagnostic standpoint, rather than just saying, well, every single time it's high, it's due to exercise. You know, I wouldn't be opposed to doing a little bit more digging, you know, just to check, because that happens to be a somewhat important organ last time I checked.
Yeah, we want you to keep your liver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got this methylation part of the diet and nutrition where we look at things like folate, choline, homocysteine, B12, liver enzymes, things along those lines. And then it looks like the report moves on to vitamins and micronutrients. So what can we learn from that?
So these are predominantly going to be gene SNPs, although there are some labs as well. So, you know, you already mentioned that you're a faster caffeine metabolizer. So that's mentioned here. We talk about things like SLC3008, which is related to a zinc transporter. And I don't know if you noticed, Ben, but your zinc levels have been kind of low pretty consistently.
Yeah, I ran out of that black ant powder. I should probably start eating that again. That stuff's like, yeah, 10 times higher in zinc than shellfish or any other source. I was using that. I'm not joking for a while in my coffee, and then I just kind of quit. But it looks like my zinc's kind of low.
Yeah, and genetically you're predisposition for that. And if your zinc levels are low and you've got this genetic predisposition, then you get DOMS more than other people. So this could be, you know,
delayed DOMS. Onset muscle soreness.
Exactly. Yeah. So using, especially people who have the specific SNP, we often have them take zinc after, you know, strenuous exercise to help reduce the DOMS basically.
Yeah. I think a lot of people aren't aware of that there are genes like that SLC3008 gene for delayed onset muscle soreness, or the other one that you guys have listed there, the COL5A1 gene for tendinopathies and potential for increased collagen breakdown that would dictate that. If someone's listening in and you're struggling with post-workout soreness and you're doing everything right, you know, all your recovery biohacks and modalities, et cetera, you know, for something like that SLC gene, increase zinc intake, or if you have that COL gene, as you guys note on my report, increase your collagen intake, you know, with things like, you know, you have listed there sardines or bone broth as sources of collagen protein. And I think a lot of people, you know, that's something that's not discussed a lot, is if you get sore a lot, there are actually genes that can dictate that risk for soreness.
Yeah, and with like the collagen 5A1, there are other considerations as well. So, for example, you should probably not be on a fluoroquinolone like ciprofloxacin or levofloxacin if you do get sick. So just knowing these things can really make a big difference, because that increases your risk for Achilles tendon rupture as well. And having that gene plus taking that antibiotic, you're going to be at more of a risk. So it's good information. And I think another important point here is we talk about increasing your collagen. We give you food examples. Sometimes we could fall in this trap of reductionist medicine and talking about these individual vitamins and minerals, but we always are going to be pushing people to get these in foods if possible. The whole wild health, the wild is partly due to this multi-omic approach. It's kind of wild and out there in advanced medicine, but it's also an allusion to the wild and the wilderness and getting these things from nature anytime we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. And I appreciate the real food recommendations that are on here as well. So the other part of the diet and the nutrition recommendations is, it looks like there are certain, speaking of foods, like superfoods that you guys recommend that are going to be especially good for me. We talked about some of those collagenous sources, foods that are rich in zinc. It appears that some of my superoxide dismutase and glutathione genes would dictate that I could use perhaps some support from antioxidant-rich foods, you know, or cruciferous vegetables, etc. And this kind of leads me into another question that I know people are going to ask. So I'm just going to jump right in and ask it. When the report says, you know, eat more, you know, foods high in folate, like leafy greens, cilantro, arugula, chards, watercress, rutabaga, bok choy, etc. Let's say I eat those foods, artichoke, dandelion, spinach, in decent amounts and get things like gut distress, bloating, gas, a lot of things that have shifted many people to take a more carnivorous approach, for example, due to plant anti-nutrients or you know, fiber-causing issues, etc. How do you guys kind of jive how the gut responds to these superfoods versus how, you know, some of these genetic pathways respond to the superfoods?
Yeah, well, as you notice, again, it's a free text box. So we have very few things listed here, but we have a lot of ideas. So we talk to you about what, not only what do you like, but what have you tried in the past? And then we run some experiments based on your past experience, your DNA and your blood work, and then what you want to try. I mean, we're talking to Paul Saladino in a couple of days for our podcast, and we frequently will have someone try a carnivore diet for certain reasons. And other people are much more plant-based than the animal-based. So this is partly DNA, partly blood work, but then what have you tried? What worked for you? How did you feel in these different diets? And how did you do the diet? Maybe you did the carnivore diet, but all you ate was muscle meat. Well, that's not the way to do it. So we do a little bit of education here to get you on the right diet for you in the correct way for you as well.
And I'd want to know a little bit more about what sort of bloating you're getting and what sort of symptoms you're getting with some of these foods too, because I might be thinking about SIBO or microbiome problems. So, I mean, there are other things to contextualize here and consider, and that's why the conversation is so important.
Right, exactly. That's what I find with a lot of people is typically it is either SIBO or SIFO, like a small intestine fungal infection that can contribute to bloating and gas in the presence of otherwise healthy foods. It's something that I think a lot of people, especially very active individuals who tend to have more gut inflammation anyways, tend to deal with. And so, you know, it's always something that you need to take an individualized approach to, for sure. You know, and in my case, I found I need to mitigate those foods and that my gut is much more stable when I'm not eating large amounts of fiber, raw vegetables, etc., and potentially even using things like supplements to get some of my glutathione or some of my antioxidants without the large food bulk.
Definitely. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's why it's just so important to have a good conversation with your patients.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it looks like you guys also dig into, after you get through the food recommendations, exercise and recovery. And we obviously talked about some of those things that would affect like collagen breakdown or delayed onset muscle soreness, but it appears you also make some pretty, like there's an actual full-on exercise program written out for me here. So what are you guys looking at when it comes to dictating how someone should exercise or how someone should recover?
The main things that we look at are genetics and your preferences. So the most important things are your genomic predispositions for different types of exercise. And then what kind of athlete do you want to be? You know, I mean, it's important. I mean, obviously, just because you've got an endurance preference doesn't mean I'm going to go out and tell you to run a 5K. You might be more interested in building strength. So that's completely going to change the plan that we create for you. But we can use the genetics to help us design that plan. And that's what basically we're doing here. So on this page, we're looking at sort of endurance versus strength. We're looking at fast or slow recovery. And we're looking at your own genomic preference for intensity. And looking at each one of these genes, we can sort of then use that to manipulate the weekly or monthly plan that we create for you. So here, Ben, you are extremely balanced in all these areas. So you're kind of right in the middle on endurance versus strength. I think you had a slight preference towards endurance. You're dead middle for recovery.
I've noted that on other. I think I did a DNA fit test years ago, and it's frustrating. Basically, it means I'm kind of like a Batman. I'm decent at most sports and can get through, you know, a CrossFit workout, but also a marathon and also a powerlifting session. But I'm based on genetics, never going to be stellar at any of those. I'm just like middle of the road. I'm this complete balance of endurance and strength.
Very negative on yourself. I think I'd call you a renaissance.
I'm a renaissance man of fitness, but I'm never going to be a professional power lifter or an elite marathoner.
And we're working on the basketball score. We'll have that on the next version as well. Yeah.
So these different genes here allow us to sort of create this report. And what we've done is, I'll skip to the next page and actually show you the report. We've created these specific longevity exercise plans that take in all of that into account. And right now there's about 12 different plans. And these are designed towards people who have a preference towards strength, endurance, if they have no preference, and then as well looking at their genetics to help decide how to create the plan for them. And it's basically, you know, anywhere from 4 to 6 days of activity. activity, broken down into things like, you know, HIIT training, zone two cardio, sprint interval training, strength training, core and mobility. So we really try to go over every aspect of it and try to hit it from all different directions. And then if we go back to your exercise plan here, we can actually talk some of the specific SNPs that come into play here. Like we mentioned, the COL 5A1 and the SLC, but also there's ones that sort of play here in terms of recovery, like IL-6, CRP, SOD2. All of these are affecting the sort of hormetic response that you get from exercise and how we can kind of use that to determine how regularly you need to be working out, how you should respond to that hormetic response with recovery.
And this report, this exercise plan, is not something we would give to like our pro athletes who we're seeing. This is more of a beginner plan, where to start. If you're a pro athlete or really advanced, like someone like you, then we're just going to take your plan and maybe give some slight suggestions and modifications. So this is really not for someone like you, but it is a helpful thing if people just don't know where to start.
Yeah, it's interesting. I noticed that one of the things that you guys have on the exercise recommendations is you look at sex hormone binding globulin, which is something that can bind to total testosterone, limit the availability of free testosterone that's active in circulation. And if that is extremely elevated, sometimes you'll have recommendations, as you have here, like discontinue fasted training or other parameters that could, you know, increase stress dramatically or cause elevated cortisol, which seems to go hand in hand with high sex hormone binding globulin often. You know, add carbohydrates before and after the training session, et cetera. But I'm kind of curious if you guys have run into this, because there's one population that I have noted, no matter what, tends to have elevated sex hormone binding globulin. And I suspect it has something to do with the fact that that's also a protein that's responsible for some amount of fat shuttling throughout the body. And that is active individuals eating a high fat, low carb diet. Even people who are total yogis, low stress, you know, I often see this in my clients who are even like, you know, independently wealthy, low cortisol, and they just have high sex hormone binding globulin. And the one time I see it happen, even without stress and without a lot of other endocrine issues, is high fat, low carb diet combined with physical activity. Have you guys seen that in your own practice much?
I have definitely. But I'll tell you, Ben, it's hard to tell the difference between that and too much stress. And sometimes I struggle with how best to measure that and come to a decision of, oh, this is probably just your diet and high fat. So in those patients, I'll often end up getting a Dutch test and getting better an idea of their HPA axis to try to figure out what exactly is going on. Because as you know, a single cortisol level is not a very good measure of, you know, what your current stress level is. And I see this all the time where patients who are just overstressed, not getting enough sleep or exercising too much, not getting enough recovery, will get elevations in their sex hormone binding globulin. So, I mean, I also will say that I don't always treat SHBG, especially if your free testosterone is normal, because it's not really that important if you're getting a normal amount of free T rolling around. But if it is an issue and say your T is borderline or you've got low free T, then there are things that we can do to help intervene there outside of just telling you to sleep more and exercise less. And that's where things like, for example, boron comes in or DIM, or just maybe even changing your diet, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. The only other interesting relic on SHBG that I've come across is actually a very high fiber diet also appears to jack SHBG levels up. So that's something else that kind of throws a wrench into the equation. It's again, something interesting to look at, but I think it needs to be contextualized. I think many people, you know, beat themselves up for having high sex hormone binding globulin when it might not be an issue, and you know, could be a relic of diet, activity levels, and not just rampant stress or endocrine dysfunction.
Yeah, I mean, you could make a case for just checking a free testosterone and not even checking SHBG, because it tends to get people upset because it's all out of range. But if their free T is not low, then it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, yeah. And then after you spit out these recommendations based on genetics for exercise, I noticed there's a whole workout program that's actually all written out. And this workout program is this generated by a computer based on my strength/endurance balance from a genetic standpoint?
Yeah, so this is a full month basically that we spit out, and it's like I mentioned, it's broken down into multiple different sections. We're actually getting ready to release version 2 of this already, which is really exciting. So it's going to include more direct preferences. So we'll have plans specifically for power lifters, for runners, for cyclists, so that we can really sort of get more granular with the types of exercise, types of activities, and also we're creating mesocycles. So instead of just having a single month or a couple month plan, we're going going to have an entire year of plans that we've created out for our patients. And people will get to sort of decide, all right, I want to do the cycling plan, or I want to do the powerlifting plan. And that'll allow them to really get granular in terms of what they should actually be doing, as opposed to this one, which is really just sort of designed very generically for longevity. It's like, let's hit all the major things that we think improve longevity.
Yeah. Yeah. Somebody needs to go through with the spell checker, though. There are a lot of these exercises are spelled incorrectly. You guys may want to audit the whichever part of the computer is writing these out, but the program itself actually looks pretty comprehensive. So it's kind of cool that someone could take this and actually go forth and just have an exercise program that's customized to their genetics, which actually there is some research showing that you do see better fitness gains when you exercise according to genetics. So it's not just something folks are throwing out there. I've seen some interesting studies on improvements in fitness when you train based on your endurance and strength tendencies. So now after exercise, then it comes back to sleep. We already discussed sleep and kind of went through that section. And so it looks like after sleep, then it gets into something called neurobehavioral. What's going on there?
Yeah, so neurobehavioral, we actually talked about some of these already. Matt mentioned this when he was talking about your FAAH gene, which is the one that determines how you use basically CBD and whether you get a sleep benefit from CBD. There's other things that pop out here just sort of in like neurocognitive function. Like, for example, this BDNF, you have a BDNF SNP, which means that you produce less BDNF and would likely benefit from things like lion's mane, for example, or exercising regularly, which I've heard that you do sometimes.
Yeah, or sauna. Sauna is amazing for BDNF.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've heard you do that too. This is the same place you'd see other things like COMT enzymes, which you don't have anything interesting there. So it didn't populate according to this program, but it'll talk a little bit about sort of your risk for anxiety, your risk for, dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, BDNF, FAAH, things like that, which will give you some idea of sort of tips and tricks to hack your neurological function, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And the one on CBD is super interesting, that fatty acid amide hydrolase function, based on breakdown of cannabinoid CBD and THC. It basically says I have less addictive potential towards CBD and THC and better sleep with CBD. I think some of those endocannabinoid genetics are just fascinating.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And then if you had the opposite version of the FAAH, you would actually get better anxiety response with CBD. So even though people who don't get the sleep response usually have a better anxiety response with CBD. So it's kind of positive both ways, I guess, how you look at it.
Yeah, and then it gets into microbiome, and I should clarify, you guys didn't send me tests to take. You took, I think in this case, you took my longevity results and pulled them into the test in the same way you took my Oura Ring results, other lab results that I shared with you. And so someone can literally take the tests that they've already have done and then send them over to you guys to feed into this clarity report. And it looks like you did that with my microbiome panel. Did you find anything interesting when you pulled in my gut results?
Yeah, I mean, like the rest of your stuff, Ben, it looks pretty good. So your inflammation score was extremely low. Your diversity score was extremely high. And that's the pattern you want. Low inflammation, high diversity. So those are good things. There were, if we pull out, specific flora, there were a few that were interesting that we could talk about. Like, for example, your proteobacteria were a little bit high. So 57th percentile on proteobacteria. And we really prefer you be sort of in the like less than 30% range. And, things like prebiotics, probiotics, sometimes berberine can actually help with proteobacteria. I'm not sure if you've taken berberine in the past. Mm-hmm. And having high levels of proteobacteria is going to cause things like, for example, IBS symptoms, metabolic syndrome, obviously not an issue. But autoimmune disease is something to think about as well. So sometimes you'll get some autoimmunity from the proteobacteria themselves. So something to potentially work on. Another one, the F. peruncii. We could also increase prebiotics here, can also cause some IBS. We don't need to talk about any IBS symptoms on air, but these are areas where there is some opportunity for improvement that we could look at specifically.
Got it. So you're looking at specific bacterial strains and saying, okay, this one's low, this one's high. We can take dietary interventions to say increase Acromantia or to increase bifidobacteria. And have you guys found, because I've seen some pushback against companies like, Viome, Longevity, et cetera, that just because you have a certain gut flora, that there's not a lot of evidence that by taking probiotic XYZ, you can shift the bacterial balance in any specific direction. What are your guys' feelings in terms of the evidence right now, in terms of being able to significantly shift gut bacteria based on something like probiotic implementation with the specific bacterial strain that you're low in, for example?
Probiotics are extremely difficult to to get much benefit from, I think, for the goal of changing your specific gut bacteria. So I think you're stuck with prebiotics in that case, and changing and sort of lifestyle and dietary interventions. I will say that, like, if you look at the F to B ratio, which is a common thing that's been looked at in lots of research, that changes pretty readily with dietary changes. So if you eat, for example, a high carb diet, you're going to have a higher F to B ratio. So your Firmicutase is higher than your Bacteroides. But if you're eating more vegetables, if you eat a more plant-based diet, then you typically have a lower F to B ratio. And we've seen that at least changes fairly well. And I think a lot of these others do as well. Villanella, for example, your villanella is off the charts. Do you know why? Villanella eats lactic acid. So All that interval training that you're doing, the villanella in your gut is actually buffering the lactic acid. And there's been studies that have shown that people with higher villanella levels are actually better athletes, and they perform better under high intensity programs because the villanella itself is actually buffering the lactic acid and eating the lactic acid. So it's reducing it, so your liver doesn't have to do all the work.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some company, I think it's called Kraft, they just sent me probiotics that are fashioned after the exact bacterial strain found in the gut of professional athletes, hypothesizing that if you take the probiotics that contain the same bacteria found in the gut of pro athletes, you could somehow increase your exercise performance. The bottle sits unopened in my pantry, but at some point I plan on opening it and seeing if I notice anything in terms of exercise performance by, I guess, turning myself into a pro athlete by taking a capsule, which I'm pretty sure is a fast track to getting into the Olympics.
Probably so. No, in all honesty, I am a little dubious of a lot of the claims that these companies make. So I think there is certainly there's something really big here with the microbiome, but I think we're just scratching the surface and getting there. I'm really excited about companies like Longevity, who are not only measuring this and reporting it, but doing some really cool science into what we can affect and where the benefits are. So I think we're just getting started with the microbiome, but I do think there are a lot of dubious claims out there right now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all over the map. I think, again, paying attention to how you personally look, feel, and perform with a certain gut protocol is, in my opinion, just at the top of the totem pole. Still, as simple and stupid as that is, I just think we're still in our infancy with a lot of these gut tests and the results that they give. Now, how about cardiovascular disease? It looks like cardiovascular disease and chronic disease are the next components that are jumped into. It looks like cardiovascular disease, dementia, insulin resistance, and inflammation. So these are more parameters based on, you know, how likely I am to have an increased risk for mortality, it looks like. So what are we looking at there?
So for cardiovascular disease, we start off with a couple different risk scores. The first one is basically MESA. So MESA is a large study that was published several years ago. It looks at sort of your 10-year cardiovascular risk. And in order to plug your numbers into this bin, you have to be 45 years old. So I had to fudge and say that you were 45. And if you were 45, your 10-year risk of having a MI or a cardiac event prior to 55 would be 1.4%. So you're looking really good there. We also look at something called a genetic cardiovascular disease risk score, and that uses the 27 different genes on this right-hand side over here that you can see are colored in different shades to assess how you compare to the rest of the wild health population. So you're in the light green on that. So you're doing pretty good when it comes to genetic cardiovascular disease risk. These two things kind of help us, like, sort of create an initial understanding of what risk this person has sitting in front of us. And then we can use some of these biomarkers down here to sort of help assess that risk. And for the most part, as we've mentioned already, your biomarkers look really good. Like, we look at some more specific things like LP little a, for example, which yours was 14, which is great. Your triglycerides were excellent, as mentioned. Your ratio of your HDL to triglycerides was 2, which is excellent. So your HDL is twice as much as your triglycerides. And then if I look at your LDL particle number, this is actually sort of old data. So the 859 was from I think a couple of years ago. You haven't had one recently, but it looked excellent then. It was 859. And then your inflammatory markers, we look at omega-3 here, your CRP, as well as your LPPLA2. LPPLA2 is an inflammatory marker that comes from inside the vessel walls. So as your inflammatory cells are basically eating cholesterol, they release this marker of LPPLA2. So it can be kind of like a immediate marker of, is there plaque being developed right now inside your arteries? And 128 is totally normal. So looking at all of these, my comfort level with your cardiovascular risk is very high right now.
Yeah, and what's interesting, I had emailed you about this a couple of weeks ago. I had a client with high LPPLA2 and was investigating whether high-dose niacin would be an appropriate tactic for him, because that's often something that's mentioned as a treatment for LPPLA2. And then in looking at the research, and this is why I reached out to you guys, it appears that some people's genetics dictate that their LPPLA2 goes up when they take niacin, and other people it goes down. And so, like, as we're getting into the realm where we can more and more look at personalized genetics, it turns out that that's definitely something to pay attention to, especially when you're, say, taking a certain supplement to get a certain function. It may shift you up when you were trying to go down, or down when you're trying to go up. And I just thought that was super interesting. I wasn't even aware that, you know, niacin could actually increase vascular inflammation in some cases and decrease it in others, and all that was based on genetics.
Yeah, niacin's a nasty drug, and we have to watch really closely with all these markers anytime we put somebody on it, which I'm doing less and less these days. And one thing I will say is that these biomarkers are easily repeatable and something that we should be doing on a regular basis on our patients to get an idea for how they're responding to diet, exercise, any medications or supplements that we put them on, because you'll see pretty broad changes with these even in a matter of weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so then it looks like kind of towards the end of the report, you get into longevity. And I assume what we're looking at there are things like telomere length, things along those lines.
Yeah, exactly. So we have an epigenetic age on you, which we plotted up here as your biological age versus your chronological age. I think I gave you a couple years on chronological age just to make you look a little better, Ben. Here we've got sort of each one of your genes for all these different areas that we think play very highly into longevity, like, for example, oxidative stress, telomeres, and dementia risk, your metabolic issues, and then cancer risk, of course. Your cancer genes look great so far. Telomeres are the only place that you're really having some difficulty, Ben. And then, of course, we look at our longevity labs here that are a good marker for sort of how you're reacting to your genes. And looking at those, your DHEA level, which has been found to be, you know, one of the best biomarkers for aging, actually, was great at 277. Your IGF was kind of right in the middle of things, which is about where you want to be. It's a U-shaped curve, so you want to be there. And then, you know, one thing that was interesting was your TSH was a little bit higher this time than it has been on past labs, Ben. Did you notice that on your most recent lab test?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I finished racing Ironman, my thyroid I had TSHs that were like up in the sixes, and that's not uncommon in endurance athletes, especially endurance athletes who, like I was at the time, really mitigating carbohydrate consumption. And I see that over and over again. I had a physician actually put me on Armour Thyroid, which I took for several years, and it seems to allow my TSH to normalize. And, you know, as I kind of cleaned things up and decided that, you know, I'm not doing a lot of heavy endurance racing. I'm not doing, you know, like this strict ketogenic thing. I should just, you know, stop taking thyroid support since I doubt I need it. And I did. And I noticed my TSH did kind of climb up a little bit. But at the same time, I don't have like cold hands, cold feet, you know, brittle nails, hair and skin issues, anything that from a symptomatic standpoint would indicate thyroid issues. And so, you know, I'm kind of using a wait and see approach, because I think over the next, you know, couple of years, as I get farther and farther from, you know, beating myself up with excess endurance combined with, you know, inadequate nutrient or caloric intake, that my thyroid should normalize. But I suspect that's the reason, is that I was on thyroid replacement and then stopped.
Yeah. And we try not to jump immediately on things like this. I mean, because you could say, hey, this is how it's put you on some Armour Thyroid. However, we find that as you start to optimize everything else, some individual markers like this just get better. So in this case, we would usually probably just say, hey, what's going on? Talk through all the things you were talking about. Do you have any symptoms? And then let's just recheck it in a month or two and see where you're going. Because I think this is a problem. A lot of times people get put on medications or things and they get better. They may have gotten better anyway, but they'll never know. And then they end up taking that for the rest of their life. So we try to be a little slower reaching for the prescription pad. We'll use medications if we need to, but we like to take a slightly more conservative approach and go a little slower before we add things like that.
Interesting. And when it comes to telomeres, you noted that some of my telomere status is subpar, but this is based on genes like TERT and SIRT1 that would affect telomere length. So it's not a direct measurement of telomeres, which I don't place a ton of faith in anyways. It's more my own genetic risk for the potential for telomere shortening, thus dictating some of the recommendations on things like, you know, using NAD or resveratrol or some of these things that if someone has a genetic risk for shorter telomere length, may benefit them. So that this wasn't an actual blood analysis of telomeres. This is more of a genetic analysis of telomere shortening risk, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I didn't design the report to actually input any telomere data into it, just because I, like you, I'm not very confident in that data. We do use epigenetic testing, like, you know, DNA methylation, as well as age bio, so biomarker measurements of aging for biological age. So those are the two things that we can input into the program as actual data points.
Gotcha.
But yeah, telomeres, I'm not so confident.
Okay, got it. Well, wow, and then I guess that's the end of the report there after it gets through longevity. So there's a lot on this thing. Now, are you guys just using me as a guinea pig, or did you already kind of roll? Like, could someone go get this test?
They can. Yeah, I mean, if you go to wildhealth.com, it is not a report that you can just get without seeing someone, because again, I mean, we kind of hit on this over and over and over. This has to be contextualized. Like when you're at increased risk for something, how much? If we can decrease a certain risk, well, at what cost? Like, this is really important, and for that provider-patient relationship. So right now, you can get this report, but it's through us and with us. There are quite a few of us providers who are doing this, but we're also training more. So if a medical provider wanted to learn how to use this and get access to it, then we're training people. So at wildhealth.com, we also have a fellowship program. But yes, you can get this report, but it's important that it's in the context of a physician relationship.
Yeah, I think the biggest takeaway for me after going through all this with you and getting a chance to look at my report this morning prior to our call is that, once again, like, you need someone who's actually able to look objectively at this that goes beyond just a computer, and someone who can ask you questions like, how'd you exercise leading into this test? You know, what are you currently training for? Sure, your recommendation says higher fiber and higher carb, but how's your gut do with higher fiber or higher carb? And a lot of these factors that I think are still like the subtle nuances that you need a real live human being to be able to dig into with you. I just think that it's almost dangerous to take a report like this and just run with the recommendations willy-nilly without actually thinking about some of the, especially the environmental and activity factors.
100% agree. And if you don't, if you're a provider or you want to learn more about this and you're, you don't want to do the whole fellowship or something like that, we're super excited about, and we're going to be doing some more courses next spring. I think you're going to come out and join us in the springtime, where we'll do some more education on this, but also actually really dig into some of the more wild side. So we're doing a lot of wildcrafting and things. So we'd love to meet people too, if they want to come and talk more about this and learn more about it in person.
Yeah. Yeah. And do we have any kind of, I should ask you guys this before the podcast, but we'll just open the kimono and do it right now for the listeners. Are we going to include any kind of like a discount code or anything like that for people to be able to try this test out for themselves?
Yeah. We haven't really talked about it or gotten approval from anybody else, but sure. You know, Ben,
you guys are the bosses. We'll figure, well, what we'll do is we'll chat afterwards and work something out. And what I can do for all my listeners is, if Mike and Matt give me some kind of a code for you guys to what's the test cost right now, guys?
So the test itself just comes with being our patient. So there's not an actual cost to this test. So when you sign up to be one of our patients, we just use this, we run it over and over. It's designed to be able to follow you over time. So we could re-input sleep data now and get a different report for you, or we could do new labs tomorrow. So this is just part of the whole relationship that you get. But we will certainly have a discount code at wildhealth.com, whether you're talking about the conference that we'll do next year, whether you're talking about being a patient and all of that. If you put Ben in, we'll talk about how much of a discount we can do.
Okay, cool. We'll work that out later. What I'll do for those of you listening in is, once we get that worked out, if you just go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity, I'll make sure in the show notes I include any kind of special link or code that you could use that would give you a VIP status with Wild Health. So we'll throw something in there for my listeners if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity, which is where I'll also link to the other three episodes I've done that are super interesting with Mike and with Matt. Guys, this is fascinating stuff. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing all this with my listeners and putting up with my nitpicky questions.
No, we've already fired our spell checker, so we'll get that fixed for you. And this report is a living report. We're updating it daily as we learn more and as more science comes out. So we're really excited to share it with the world.
Awesome. Awesome. I dig it. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed this show, and we did a screenshot overview as well, and I'm also making it so you can download the PDF of my report if you just want to see what it looks like. And again, all that's going to be at bengreenfieldfitness.com slash clarity. And I'm sure you'll be hearing more from the good folks at Wild Health. Like Matt mentioned, I'll probably be in spring of 2021 taking part in another event down there at their fantastic castle in Kentucky, kind of like the Wild Health headquarters down there. So if you pay attention to my calendar or my newsletter or my podcast, I'll let you guys know if any of that stuff's open to the public, because if you get a chance to go down there, they've actually got a really cool thing going on in Lexington with their castle and their whole setup down there. So stay tuned for more on that. And in the meantime, grab all the show notes at bengreenfieldfitness.com/clarity. Until next time, I'm Ben Greenfield, along with Drs. Matt Dawson and Mike Mullen, signing out from bengreenfieldfitness.com. Have an amazing week.
Well, thanks for listening to today's show. You can grab all the show notes, the resources, pretty much everything that I mentioned over at bengreenfieldfitness.com, along with plenty of other goodies from me, including the highly helpful Ben Recommends page, which is a list of pretty much everything that I've ever recommended for hormones, sleep, digestion, fat loss, performance, and plenty more. Please also know that all the links, all the promo codes that I mentioned during this and every episode help to make this podcast happen and to generate income that enables me to keep bringing you this content every single week. So when you listen in, be sure to use the links in the show notes, use the promo codes that I generate, because that helps to float this thing and keep it coming to you each and every week.